Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, Joan Knows. Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, brings us the Vatican Week in Review. But first, we present There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, a programme presented and produced by Jill Bevilacqua, which begins, as always, with Sean Patrick Lovett reading the Gospel for us.
As the crowd pressed in on Jesus to hear the word of God, he saw two boats moored by the side of the lake. The fishermen had disembarked and were washing their nets. He got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to pull out a short distance from the shore. Then, remaining seated, he continued to teach the crowds from the boat. When he'd finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into deep water and lower your nets for a catch." Simon answered, "Master, we have been hard at it all night long and have caught nothing. But if you say so, I will lower the nets." Upon doing this, they caught such a great number of fish that their nets were at the breaking point. They signaled to their mates in the other boats to come and help them. These came, and together they filled the two boats until they nearly sank. At the sight of this, Simon Peter fell at the knees of Jesus, saying, "Leave me, Lord, I am a sinful man." For indeed, amazement at the catch they had made seized them and all his shipmates, as well as James and John, Zebedee's sons, who were partners with Simon. Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. From now on, you will be catching men." With that, they brought their boats to land, left everything, and became his followers.
We've come to that most familiar of scenes, that most significant of gospel episodes, the miraculous draught of fish and the calling of the first disciples. Jesus is standing by the lake, the crowd pressing in on him. He sees two boats moored by the lakeside, and nearby are the fishermen washing their nets. In Mark and Matthew's Gospels, the calling of the first four disciples is presented differently. We're told that Peter and Andrew are casting their nets, when he calls them and tells them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." And they left their nets at once and followed him. And going on from there, we read he sees the other two, James and John, with their father Zebedee, mending their nets. And at his call, they too follow him immediately, leaving nets, boat, father, with the men he employed, adds Mark. Neither Mark nor Matthew recount the miracle described by Luke in such detail. They concentrate on the call and the immediate response. No hesitation. They also use the plural when Jesus calls the disciples. "I will make you fishers of men." Mark, who was Peter's amanuensis, would have received from him only what Peter wanted recorded. And as one writer comments, Peter was not given to telling of miracles that involved himself. As for Matthew, the tax collector, a great haul of fish would not have impressed him in the same way as a miracle of healing. But for Luke, the figure of Peter stands out in this account. It is his boat that Jesus chooses to teach from. And throughout its centuries, the church has been referred to as Peter's boat, or more poetically, the bark of Peter, and represented as such by artists. The most famous of these was the so-called Navicella of Giotto, a mosaic showing the bark of St. Peter tossed among the waves and Christ walking in on the waters. It can still be seen today, or a fragment of it, scarcely distinguished among the shadows, writes Georgina Masson. Recovered from old St. Peter's when it was demolished in 1506, the mosaic was placed inside the porch over the central arch in the new basilica. Giotto made the mosaic in 1289, and we're told was paid 2,200 gold florins for his work. And it's said of Cardinal Baronius, disciple of St. Philip Neri, that whenever he passed this symbolic representation of Christ's church, he reverently uncovered his head. A charming legend is recounted by Irish poet Seamus Heaney. It regards the monastery of Clonmacnoise in County Offaly. Once the most celebrated religious foundation in the country, it's now only a melancholy ruin. But, writes Max Caulfield, well worth a visit.
Magnificently set in a sylvan bend of the Shannon, the longest natural waterway in the British Isles, This ancient walled monastic site is best approached by boat along the river from Athlone, so that its antique graves, early Christian buildings, round towers and high crosses rise majestically out of the morning mists that cloud in across the water.
And with that atmospheric introduction, let's listen now to the poem.
The annals say, when the monks of Clonmacnoise were all at prayers inside the oratory, a ship appeared above them in the air. The anchor dragged along behind so deep, it hooked itself into the altar rails, and then, as the big hull rocked to a standstill, a crewman shinned and grappled down the rope and struggled to release it, but in vain. This man can't bear our life here and will drown, the abbot said, unless we help him. So they did. The freed ship sailed, and the man climbed back out of the marvelous as he had known it.
The episode recounted in the Gospel probably took place in the neighbourhood of Capernaum, where Jesus had settled after he had left Nazareth. An ancient fishing town on the northwestern shore of the lake, it had also become Peter's town. He and his brother originally came from Bethsaida, another fishing town, as its name, which means house of fishing, implies. Although its exact site is not known, we read in the guidebook.
It is commonly accepted that Bethsaida was located on the northeastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, in the Beteka Valley, a marshy area where rivers coming down from the Golan Heights drain into the sea.
The people of Bethsaida, we know from the Gospels, didn't accept Jesus and his teachings, and together with Chorazin was cursed by him. Woe to thee, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. So we read in Matthew. And the guidebook concludes.
It is thought that the curse was so powerful that Bethsaida completely disappeared from memory.
And what did Peter think, I wonder? The town of Mary Magdalene was also on the western shore of the lake and was, writes the guidebook, a fish products industrial centre, adding that its Greek name, Trakai, means the place for salting the fish. H.V. Morton, who writes that dyeing was the industry of Magdala, fills in the picture of the activities carried on in the lakeside area.
In the time of Jesus, the Sea of Galilee was one of the busiest centres of life in the country. The western shore was ringed with towns and villages, and the lake was crowded with ships. The trades carried on round the lake were boat building, dyeing at Magdala, pottery works and fish curing. The large curing factory was at Tarikaya, the pickling place to the south of the lake, where fish were salted and packed for export. There was always a big market for salt fish in Jerusalem. In Old Testament times, the fish trade seems to have been in the hands of the Tyrians and the Egyptians. The fish gate of ancient Jerusalem, round which the fish market was held, lay near the northern gate, the natural entrance from Tyre. It seems fairly certain, however, that about 50 years before the time of Christ, the Greeks broke this monopoly by introducing the fish-curing industry to the Sea of Galilee. Pliny says that in his time, the pickling place at Tarikaya gave its name to the whole lake, which suggests that the industry must have been at first a Greek enterprise. The trade must have expanded enormously, for we know that barrels of these cured fish were carried all over the Mediterranean world, and that enormous quantities were sent to Jerusalem every spring for the Passover crowds on pilgrimage to the temple.
And so, on that day in May, for so it apparently was, Jesus stood by the lake, which was still enveloped in the mists of early morning. There would have been plenty of noise, though, even at that time, from the shouts of fishermen who'd had a good catch and were on their way down to the curing sheds, to the hammers of the boat builders and the general hubbub and bustle of a busy place of this kind. Added to this, the throngs that would have accompanied Jesus from the moment it was known that he was in the vicinity. Jesus is speaking to them, but as the crowds increase and people push each other, as they do, in an effort to hear and see better, he finds himself more or less imprisoned on three sides. But then he spots the empty boats, moored nearby, and the fishermen, who are his friends. Indeed, also his disciples, though not yet totally committed. But that situation will be very soon rectified. Jesus steps into the boat of Simon Peter, and asks him to pull out a bit from the shore. He then sits down in the boat and resumes his preaching. We're not told what he said to the crowds that day. It's what happened afterwards that Luke wants us to know. The first words quoted here are, "put out into deep water," or in that older, euphonious phrase, "launch out into the deep." One can almost hear the crunch of the pebbles and the rush of water as the boat slides out. Pope John Paul II has often quoted this phrase and once declared that the Lord's invitation was almost the motto of his apostolic letter, Novo Millennio Eneunte, at the beginning of the new millennium.
As the successor of Peter, I feel it my duty to echo these words of Christ to the whole church. Christ, who is the same yesterday and today and forever, urges every ecclesial community to put out into the deep, to go forward in hope into the new millennium, which opens before us like a vast ocean on which to venture.
And now, for the first time in the Gospels, we hear Peter's voice.
Master, we have laboured all the night and have taken nothing, but at thy word I will let down the net.
For Peter, expert fisherman, the command to put out into the deep water and lower the nets for a catch, when they'd been out all night labouring fruitlessly and had only just come ashore with nothing to show for their efforts, must have seemed like sheer madness, folly, against all reason. And Peter makes his point, brusquely if you like, sincerely, frankly, for that was his way. But he immediately adds words of faith in the Master he has already accepted without reserves. Writes one scholar,
"The account of the miraculous haul of fish stresses Peter's obedience and his readiness with regard to Jesus. It also, however, shows how Peter's mission is founded only on the action of Jesus. Peter, in fact, knows he is a sinner."
Peter launches the boat into deep water, and he and his brother let down the nets.
"And when they had done this, they netted such a huge number of fish that their nets began to tear. So they signalled to their companions in the other boat to come and help them."
Lake Galilee is not particularly deep, and its waters are generally calm. But when the boats draw closer to shore and shallower water, there is a danger. H.V. Morton, our constant guide, explains.
"The Galilean fisherman who nets a heavy catch is always anxious about the net, because the bottom of the lake is covered with sharp stones for perhaps 20 or 30 feet before the sand begins. What a shouting goes up as a heavy net is drawn out of the deep water towards the sharp stones. With what care the fishermen run thigh-deep into the lake to lift the precious burden clear of rocks."
The same writer, referring to the miracle St. John recounts after the resurrection, notes the concern of the evangelist for this same reason. Again, they fish all night and catch nothing. And at daybreak, Jesus stands on the shore and tells them to cast on the right side of the boat. And when they do, they are not able to haul it in for the quantity of fish. 103 large fish, John notes. And yet, although there were so many, the net was not torn. The amount of detail in John's account our writer believes to be a conclusive proof that John was a Galilean and a fisherman. On that occasion, he was the only one who recognised the risen Jesus and told Peter, who pulled on his clothes and waded to the shore. But, writes John, the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. John actually uses the word cubits, equivalent to some 46 centimetres. So the boat was about 100 metres from the shore. A legend of Franciscan tradition relates that somewhere in the back streets of Jerusalem is the site of a house which belonged to Zebedee, father of St. John. This family apparently were fish merchants of Galilee, with a branch office in Jerusalem from which they used to supply, among others, the family of Caiaphas, the high priest. And this would explain the mysterious reference in John's Gospel to the fact that he, who refers to himself as that other disciple, was admitted to the house of the high priest after the arrest of Jesus, because he was known to the doorkeeper. Let's refresh our memory. Jesus has been arrested, taken first to Annas and now to Caiaphas. Writes John,
"Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. As this disciple was known to the high priest, he entered the court of the high priest along with Jesus, while Peter stood outside at the door. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the maid who kept the door and brought Peter in.
Well, it may be only a legend, but it throws a whole new light on that scene in the high priest's house in the early hours of that first Good Friday morning. And how otherwise, writes one, could the son of Zebedee from Galilee be known to the doorkeeper of the house of the most important man in Jerusalem? Legends aside, the miracle recounted in today's gospel regards the action and reaction of Peter, the big fisherman, and the words of our Lord spoken in answer. Peter had seen other miracles performed by Jesus, water turned to wine, miracles of healing, which to us might seem more significant than a great haul of fish. But fish were Peter's life, and this was the miracle that impressed him most profoundly, as it did his companions. But why the sudden realization of sinfulness? Comments Sheed.
Precisely because the miracle hit home to him in all the reality of its miraculousness, he suddenly saw Christ for the first time. Seeing Christ, he at last saw himself.
But Jesus reassures Peter, who has withdrawn from him, physically and even spiritually, suddenly aware of the seemingly unsurmountable abyss which separates them. And then come those words which will change the life of Peter and that of his companions forever.
Fear not, from henceforth thou shalt catch men. And having brought their ships to land, leaving all things, they followed him.
You were listening there to Jill Bevilacqua's There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Jill will be back again with the next in this series at this same time next week, so be sure to join her then. Meanwhile, time to join Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome. She brings us the Vatican Week in review. So welcome back, Joan. We're really lucky, as always, on Fridays. It's a good time to record. It's always sunny on Fridays here in Rome.
You know, it has been for months now. It's an amazing thing. The other days of the week have been very rainy and very cold, but Fridays do seem to smile on us. But, you know, I feel like we never left the studio from last week. It was another active week for those of us who cover the Vatican, for the Holy Father. And I have to say, I had some personal satisfactions this week in that the new patriarch of the Chaldean Church is someone I've known for a number of years. It was the Archbishop Louis Sacco of Kirkuk who was elected during the synod here in Rome as the patriarch. And the Holy Father met him on Monday, and there was a mass also in St. Peter's to express the communion between the Chaldean Church and Rome. So that was one very satisfying personal moment. And a second one...
Don't tell me it's connected to Zubin Mehta.
It is connected to Zubin Mehta. Monday evening, there was a concert in the Vatican to mark the 84th anniversary of the Lateran Pacts between the Vatican and Vatican City State, which was created on February 11th in 1929. And to commemorate those pacts, the president of Italy was there with his wife. He was there with the Pope. But I got very excited when I heard about Zubin Mehta being the conductor of this wonderful event, simply because I have a nephew by marriage whose name is Zubin Mehta. My nephew and the conductor's fathers were first cousins. I got to meet him, so that was lovely. And the other personal experience, until May 1st, an art exhibit officially inaugurated Wednesday night and opened Thursday at Castle San Angelo called the Camino di Pietro, the Path of Peter, and it's St. Peter's Journey in the Faith. Visit Castle Sant'Angelo because the castle itself is amazing. And then to have this bonus of this beautiful art exhibit, do follow the journey of Peter.
So talking about Peter, let's talk about the successor of Peter.
You mean
present.
The Pope? Yes, exactly. The Holy Father.
Well, Sunday Angelus.
The Sunday Angelus. As always, before the Angelus, he reflects on the readings of the day. And then afterwards, if there's an appeal to be made, the Pope always does that. The Pope talked about Jesus reads a prophecy from Isaiah regarding the Messiah, and he makes it known to his elders that this Messiah is him. It is Jesus. And, of course, then his fellow countrymen and everything are rather confused at this. And is this the son of Joseph? But how could he also be the Messiah? And Jesus talks about, he said it's natural to say that people are not accepted by their own. They might be accepted out of their own town or home country, but they're usually not accepted. They're rejected by those who know him, of all things. The Pope said when Jesus knew there would be kind of a rupture when he said these words, you know, I am the Messiah. And so why would he do that? And it said in the beginning, the Pope said, in the beginning, people admired him. And perhaps he could have even gotten them to agree on a lot of things. But this was the point, said the Pope. Jesus did not come to seek the agreement of humanity, as he will tell Pilate in the very, very end, but he came to testify to the truth. So another lesson in our own faith, in this year of faith for us. So that was the Angelus Sunday. The week kind of unrolled as it does almost every week. The traditional events are the Angelus and the Wednesday audience, and then in between you have other events like the Pope meeting the new patriarch of the Chaldeans, and
a quiet Tuesday, as always.
A quiet Tuesday, preparing for the Wednesday audience. That's when the Holy See Press Office will have the different Tuesdays and Thursdays, usually, or in this week, Tuesday and Wednesday, press conferences for events, announcing books, publications, the art exhibit. There was a big conference on that in the press office Wednesday, announcing this art exhibit at Casa San Angelo. And then Tuesday, there was a conference with Archbishop Paglia, the fairly new head of the Council for the Family. This was entitled From Milan to Philadelphia because the meeting of families that was in Milan last June, the next one will be held in 2015 in Philadelphia. And he and a couple from Milan, a married couple, spoke of the benefits, the fruits of the June 2012 family meeting and a look to the future. So there were those press conferences, and the Pope this week is meeting with the bishops of Italy. It's their turn for their every five-year mandatory ad limina visit. And so the different regions come and meet with the Holy Father. And as Benedict has been doing in recent years, unlike for many decades with John Paul in the beginning of Benedict's pontificate, he would meet with a group of bishops, meet individually, then meet that region, that area as a group, and give them a talk. Now, Holy Father gives a talk covering important issues for that particular bishops' conference. He only gives a talk every two or three regions. He did the same thing for America. I think it was 15 or so regions, and he gave like five talks instead of 15 different talks.
Joan, getting to the Wednesday general audience, he continued his catechesis for the year of faith. Now he's been speaking about the creed.
That was a brilliant, brilliant. You just have to go to the website of the Vatican. It's there, folks, in all the different languages. So you can find his catechesis. And he's talking each week about different words of the creed. This is the year of faith, the creed, what we believe, what our faith is. And so he talked this week about God as creator of heaven and earth. And The Pope's words were really almost poetic on this. And he said, you know, the world has meaning as a part of the divine plan, a plan which in a special way embraces man and woman in the culmination of God's creative activity. And he said, the scriptures teach us man was created in the image and likeness of God, formed from the dust of the earth. And so again, the Pope is talking about the creator of heaven and earth, and part of earth, of course, is not only the physical earth around us, but man and woman. And the Pope got into another lesson when he was talking about man being created in the image and likeness of God. He said, here we see the basis not only of the unity of the human family, but also of our inviolable human dignity. And he said, we see something of the mystery of man as a finite creature. However, he's called to a sublime role in God's eternal plan. And then the Pope said the tragedy of Adam's sin, which falsifies our original relationship with God, this has affected our relationship with one another and the world itself. So a very, very beautiful catechesis. And I have to say, you know, throughout time, in the years, the decades I've been in the Vatican, covering the Vatican and so forth, you say to yourself at a certain point, how can, in this instance, a pope take a certain subject and constantly make it new? How much can you say about faith or the dignity of man or what? But they always make it new. They find new words, new expressions to tell us about our faith, to tell us about our humanity, to tell us about Jesus.
We had a little bit of culture this week in the Vatican, didn't we?
Actually, it ends Saturday, the 9th of February. But for the first time, I believe, in the plenary session of any body of the Roman Curia, the first session, which was the night of the 6th, was open to the public. And it was very near where we are recording right now, the auditorium of Lumsa University, which, so not in the offices of the Pontifical Council. There was a rock concert. And Cardinal Ravasi, who heads the Council for Culture, because their theme is emerging youth cultures, he said, you know, we've got to get to know young people. We've got to dedicate our time and our talents to also looking at young people. They are the present of the church. They're the future of the church. They're the hope of the church and of the world. But the only way that we can effectively work with them and for them is to know them. And so he delved into a lot of rock music even before the council began its plenary session.
You say he was listening to Amy Winehouse.
Yes, exactly. And there was a group called The Sun present. So you had this meeting opening the plenary session, the meeting open to the public, but obviously also the members, the cardinals and the bishops and so forth, the members of the council. So the Pope's address, it's almost too bad everybody that was there at the rock concert couldn't have heard these wonderful words of the Pope, because he met the group Thursday morning, but the bishops and the consultors and so forth of the council. And he really stressed the fact that with young people today, we can't use cliched phrases. We have to get to know the new realities, including, and Cardinal Ravasi is an expert on this, including all of the ways that they learn and communicate with the social media. Cardinal Ravasi himself tweets all the time. He did, this is very interesting, because Cardinal Ravasi is known for vis-a-vis social networks, and he's an avid Twitter follower and anti-tweets. And he invited young people, this was early on, he invited young people to send questions and comments on emerging youth cultures to at the hashtag reply to the number 2. Ravasi, reply to Ravasi. So it'll be interesting to find out on the last day of the plenary of culture whether or not young people have been in touch with the cardinal. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful because if you look in the recent years, you look at synods that have talked a lot about young people, the synod of last fall, you had so many of the bishops talking about the youth and calling them, one Nigerian bishop in particular, the present of the church. They're not just the future. They might be future parents and priests and teachers, but they are the present of the church. So I think it'll be very interesting when the plenary is over to see what the different acts are, what documents they produce, what fruits, what promises, what programs. It'll be very interesting to follow on this plenary.
Well, we'll find out more next week then, Jeff.
We will. We'll report on that.
And you were listening there to Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Don't forget, while we won't be back again at this same time tomorrow, we will be back again at this same time next weekend. So be sure to join us then. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.